didn't have to create your own identity. I thought it was a good way to make a big world feel a little smaller.
That's what I was worried about, like I was going to do everything wrong and everyone would be annoyed that they had this person who sucked.
Did you ever try to get out of PE lessons?
All the time. I was really lucky in year 10 because I slipped stepping off a gutter and tore four tendons in my foot, and I somehow managed to use that to get out of PE for like 8 months straight. At first my parents would write me notes and then they realised that I was faking it, so I learned to forge my dad's signature.
Ella Stathis is speaking to Alison Chan about her memories of PE lessons in high school.
Can you describe to me the PE uniform that you had to wear growing up in high school?
Mm-hmm. So our PE uniforms were pretty daggy and disgusting. We had those horrible baggy maroon shorts that look really terrible on anyone who's not thin. If you were like me and you had kind of a big butt as a teenager, it was just slaughter to wear those. And then you had like an ugly sweaty polo shirt, which if you were really lucky, you had to tuck that in so that you looked super stylish. You know, half the fun was having to actually bring the uniform with you because, of course, you're not allowed to wear it to school. So you have to carry an extra bag and it's really, really hot. It's like 40 degrees. And then you waste half the lesson getting changed into and out of your uniform.
In theory, what do you think is the point of doing PE in high school?
I view it as a kind of hazing ritual, basically. Kind of the strong thrive and the weak just fall off like dying antelope on the Serengeti. You do a different sport each lesson. If you're good at it, you're sweet. If you suck at it, you're basically left to die in the wilderness. And I'd say at least 70% of the people at my school were just like me, just not athletically inclined. If you've never done the beep test, may you never have to suffer through that. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. So basically the entire class has to line up and run back and forth from one line to another at increasing speed. And so the beep in the beep test is the point by which you have to have reached the other line. And it gets gradually faster as you go along. And if you fall behind, I think more than two or three times, you have to sit out. You know, high school students are self-conscious, you know, and then it's basically making all of us stand up in front of all the other people that we're worried think we already suck and making us run back and forth. And again, if you were like me, you're not very athletic, you're pink, you're sweaty, you probably got a crush on someone in the class and you're having to lumber back and forth faster and faster. So yeah, it was a peculiarly, you know, unusual form of social embarrassment.
I'm wondering, what was going through the mind of your teenage self as you're in the change room?
Well, it stank, for one thing. You know, lots of hormonal teenage girls. We all spray Impulse and stuff. You know, it was the early thousands. You had those crappy sample sprays from Dolly magazine and stuff like that. At first, it was, you know, when I was younger, it was generally, you know, thinking of how uncomfortable it would be. As I got older, it was, oh, God, this is going to ruin my makeup, stuff like that. It was just kind of like, I mean, we'd all take as long as we possibly could to get changed because that meant you had to spend less time actually doing sport.
Did you ever see any injuries during PE classes?
So there was actually one pretty severe PE injury. It didn't happen to a student. It actually happened to a PE teacher. She was our head of the sports department. And she was actually hit in the head by a shot put and ended up in hospital. You know, it was terrible. But I mean, at the time we were callous 14-year-olds and thought it was hilarious. It was probably because she really, you know, put effort into the sport. You're much safer if you don't try, I think. You just stay away from all flying objects, moving parts, and that's the best way to avoid anything serious. It's one of the most performative classes. It's a bit like drama, you know. You can tell if someone's not really participating. As much as I bitch about PE, you know, honestly, my hatred for PE has very little to do with the actual teachers. It's just, you know, the woes of the unathletic teenager.
You're listening to All the Best on FBI Radio. I'm Samantha Groth. On this episode, we're getting physical. We're not going to the Commonwealth Games or running marathons, and we're definitely not getting an A in PE class. But we are getting active, using our bodies to connect with ourselves and each other. Coming up, we have a story about a group of Sydneysiders that run the biggest lesbian soccer club in the world, and a story about memories of the pool, learning to swim and meeting water for the first time. Let's dive in.
Swimming, I wish I was swimming. I wish I was swimming. I wish I was. I wish, I wish, I wish I was swimming.
I remember learning to swim and not being able to pass many, like, there were all these levels when you're in primary school and you're swimming, and I was a terrible swimmer. I could never get the technique. You know, my legs wouldn't go the right way, and I didn't enjoy swimming. But I remember that I was still swimming as other kids my age in swim classes were progressing, and I wasn't. And my mum was just like, what is wrong with you? You're still in, like, the small kids' pool. My name's Teresa Tan, and I'm currently living in Sydney. Like, I'm not a water baby. I'm not, I don't even feel like I'm from Australia. Whereas I hear about other friends and they're just like, I touched the water and it was like I was meant to be there. I've never felt like that in water. I think eventually we progressed. I definitely got progressed to the big pool because I remember almost drowning in the big pool.
I have a memory of racing and getting to the end of the pool and popping my head out and going, did I come first? And I was like fifth or something. I'm Prithvi Ratharajan. I live in Melbourne. My extended family who live in India don't know how to swim. There's not really a culture of swimming there. Like, they live in the south in Tamil Nadu, and there's not really bodies of water that aren't polluted where they can swim. So I think I was also conscious that, like, my parents couldn't swim, and it was probably exciting for me to be gaining this skill at school with friends.
I learned to swim in primary school along with every single other kid who goes to school in Brisbane.
I'm Fiona May, living in Armidale, New South Wales.
I'm from Colorado. It has four seasons, so it's a summertime sport. My name is Molly Dole, and I am from the United States, but I am currently living in Sydney. I grew up with a, like, swimming pool in my backyard. In high school, I did swim team, you know, represent your school, compete against other schools. It definitely gives you a smaller identity in high school, so it's good in that way. You have the team, they decorate your locker on competition day. You, like, wear an outfit on the day that you're going to compete, and they would literally say, okay, we're going to wear pajama pants tomorrow. So in that way, you didn't have to create your own identity. I thought it was a good way to make a big world feel a little smaller.
Actually, when I got to high school, I had a really serious knee injury. I snapped the ligaments that hold my knee together and cracked my kneecap. And because of that, the only thing I could do was swim. Like, I came out of hospital, couldn't walk, had to learn to walk. And the only thing I could do was get in the water and basically hobble around in the water. And eventually, when I got enough strength, I was only allowed to swim. And that was for 2 years as a teenager. And so whether or not I liked it, I became a swimmer. There was this noise that came from being underwater that it wasn't anything that I previously had heard of or felt. But as soon as my head goes under, I immediately didn't feel the anxieties I felt, didn't feel the awful feelings that I felt about not being able to walk anymore and not being able to play sport and, you know, the pressures of academic study or, you know, trouble at home. That all disappeared. And that was like a real reprieve for how many hours I would choose to be there. And often I would be there until it closed. Swimming in Hong Kong is a very different experience to swimming in Australia. Pools in Hong Kong are really small because there's not really space. I mean, if anyone's been to Hong Kong, you know it's, you know, space is a privilege. And therefore, pools are 25-metre pools, sometimes even 15-metre pools. My brother has a pool in his apartment complex that is 15 metres. And there's an even smaller pool next to it that is 5 to 7 metres.
Like, I don't have memories of being as free in the pool when I was a teenager. I was more conscious probably also in suburban Adelaide of being a minority. And there was sort of self-consciousness around that as well. Pools are somewhere where you're vulnerable. You strip down. If it's an outdoor pool, you're kind of quite visible there in the glare of the sun.
It was about the middle of grade 9 when
I got out of swimming altogether. I used to just come up with excuses for my mom to write a note to my PA teacher every single week. One week it would be I have an ear infection, the next week I'd have a music lesson, and then it would be that time of the month, and then I would just have something, anything, choir, Tournament of Minds, like it didn't matter. But it was just this chronic cycle of I had to get out of PE, I couldn't be seen in my swimmers, what was I going to say, what was I going to twist my mum's arm so that she would allow me to get out of this sticky situation that I found myself in every single week.
I did a PhD and there was a lot of computer work, a lot of sitting still for many, many hours. I started getting backaches and I felt like I really needed to swim. It felt like I wasn't quite switching off my mind, but I was letting it roam in a very gentle way. So there's something about moving through water in a repetitive, rhythmic fashion that I think allows your mind to kind of gently drift. For me, swimming laps is a way to be in a bit of a cocoon. So yeah, I just stay submerged, look at the lines, look at the play of the light. I like that actually, looking at the play of the light in the water.
I guess the pool's also a really interesting place to people watch, which I think is something we noticed. Being at the pool, there's other people that you notice have their routine. Like, you know, oh, that guy's always here on Fridays and then he goes into the sauna. Or that person's here on a date. Or that person's here because they're trying to, like, they've got a goal. There's some people, like, you see them and you're like, you definitely don't want to swim, but you are forcing yourself to swim. And there's an interesting narrative.
What I see at pools that I don't see anywhere else in my current life, really, is the families. On the weekends, I can tell it's a destination. On hot days, it's like, get the kids to the pool, and it's a real meeting point. So in that way, I see Australian families way more than I do in kind of my single red fern life. I've had people hit on me in pools as well. The pickup line was like, oh, you're pretty quick.
Did you ever get nice speedo?
No, the background there, I have lost a few bathing suits at Sydney pools. They're never in the lost and found, which upsets me and grosses me out. I go back the next morning every time. This has happened 3 times, and they're never there. And they're expensive. So the last time, it was, I'd gone swimming the night before. I was meeting some coworkers to go swimming the next morning, you know, 6:30 a.m. So I had to buy from the shop at the pool. The only one left is this, it's like neon green and blue tiger faces. It would look really good under a black light. It's kind of whimsical and just looks like I'm an aggressive 14-year-old swimmer. Like I'm very competitive for a child, is what this suit says about me.
It's like a swimming suit for rave parties. It's a great outfit, but not for swimming.
And then by my choice, I have a neon pink swim cap and then some like kind of green iridescent goggles. They're actually quite pretty, but yeah, I'm a full rainbow in the pool, just swimming hard.
It's a pool now.
It is a pool, honey.
I think I was still traumatized by the idea of lap pools because that was too close to school swimming. And I never visited a lap pool by choice as a young adult until recently when I started going again with my baby daughter. She was just an obvious water baby. We were constantly in and out of the water with her. We played in the water, we sang in the water. I fed her in the water at times so that all the mess could just go down the drain. You know how you sometimes hear parents say, my baby had a meltdown and I had to rock her for 2 hours straight or something. Well, we never did that. If she ever got distressed or we couldn't give her what she wanted, we'd just stick her in the shower, like seriously, and she'd fall asleep within a minute, every time without fail. We were kind of worried that it just become a Pavlovian response for her in later life, and as a grown-up she'd end up falling asleep every time she heard the water running because of us. And hopefully that will not happen. Wow.
You have to do swimming lessons.
Okay.
Who's the teacher?
Me.
So you can do the other part?
Her baby swimming classes were fun. We enrolled at 6 months of age because we heard that the pool where they hold the baby classes was really nice and steamy and warm. So partially it was a selfish reason for us to survive that freezing Armidale winter. It actually snowed on a couple of days that winter, so it was just awful. But yeah, our reasons weren't really about water confidence or getting a head start for Allegra or anything. We just saw how Allegra came alive in the water and wanted to nurture that love of swimming.
Swimming. I wish I was swimming. I wish I was. I wish I wish I wish I was.
That story was by Alison Chan, with sound design by Tegan Nichols. This week, we're getting physical. Sometimes alone, and sometimes in the biggest lesbian soccer club in the world, which just so happens to live in Sydney. Tegan Nichols followed the club through the month of Mardi Gras to find out how they've grown to this size over the past 30 years.
I'm sitting in the bleachers at the semi-final of the Sydney FC W League. I'm with friends. They play soccer. I mean, football. I don't, obviously. There's a crowd of about 2,000 people, and earlier, when I was standing in line for the bar, I heard a guy say that it was a pretty good turnout for a women's game. I'm watching the players start to tire in the February heat as the game goes into overtime, when an invitation comes my way. A Mardi Gras invitation. To march in the parade with the Flying Bats, the biggest lesbian football club in the world.
I play in the back line usually. I'm usually a right or left back.
Midfield, on the wing.
But I play it all over the place.
I've got a really good line in just standing and watching.
I do a lot of running, so I don't know why they put me there.
They aren't from Europe or the States, and they don't even play in a professional league. It may surprise you to hear that the title of the largest lesbian football club in the world is in fact held by a community group in Sydney. They formed 30 years ago, and they were one of the founding members of the first female football association in Sydney. I was curious to learn how this club grew to become the biggest of its kind. And so I decided to follow them through the month of Mardi Gras and find out what it means to be a Flying Bat. It's Fair Day, the official start to Sydney's month-long Mardi Gras festival, and Victoria Park is filled with stalls representing pretty much every kind of queer organisation in Sydney.
Join the Bats, it's the best ever!
Yeah!
Including the Bats.
I'm Emily Shrubb and I'm the current president of the Bats. I've been playing for, I think this is going to be my 12th season or thereabouts. So yeah, I've been around for a while. My sister found this club. My sister is also a gay. She asked me to come and play with her and I said yes. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, but that was one of the best decisions I've ever made.
A lot of people discover the Bats at Fair Day. But I wanted to know what motivated people to bite the bullet and actually sign up.
I'm Anna Flynn. I joined when I moved over from the UK, actually. It was one of the first things I did. I've played soccer since I was a kid. I used to play on the street, actually, at home. Been a lack of clubs around at that sort of time for women. A friend of mine was playing for a team in London, and at the time, I kind of thought it was a little bit hilarious that there was a lesbian soccer team. As I became a bit more comfortable in myself, she got me along, and the community around it was just amazing. So I'd moved out here because my partner's Australian, so I'd had no friends here at all. I didn't know at the time if I'd make friends or not, but as it transpires, pretty much my entire friendship base have come from the Bats, and the extended Bats is enormous, isn't it?
This is a Bats diaspora.
Yeah. Yeah, we get a lot of people joining the Bats for very similar reasons, and I'd say probably half of our members are from someplace else and they join the Bats to form a network.
We did our history project a couple of years ago and we estimated there was about 1,000 women that had played with the club over the 30 years. and the actual kind of bats community, friends, partners, expats. Yeah, it's easily like a couple of hundred folks that are sort of involved in particularly the social aspect.
So here's the question. Do you need to be gay to join?
I've had a few people ask me if you have to be a lesbian to join. I delight in the fact that I can say to them that we're more inclusive than today's society. So it's not a prerequisite.
My name's Emily. Sport was something that I hadn't done in years and years and years, so I kind of was already out of my comfort zone. So it was kind of nice to be able to meet some other lesbian or at least allies of the LGBTI community and kind of have that as a safety if I was doing something that I wasn't entirely comfortable with. I remember like the first time I turned up at training and one of the girls just casually mentioning her wife did this the other day or something like that. And this was before marriage equality happened too. And it was just so normal. It was kind of cool. I was like a little bit taken aback for a second that everyone was just chatting so casually and I didn't have to kind of work myself up into working in like my girlfriend or talking about a partner into a conversation and kind of worrying about how the other person's going to take it. Like it was such a nothing thing.
The association the Bats play in have seven divisions. Div 1 is usually for the players who have the most experience and the most skill. Div 7 are for those who have the least of these things. This means that when you join up with the Bats, one of the first things you do is grade.
I've only done about 5 minutes and I'm ready to go home now.
Now, the idea of being judged on sporting ability is enough to trigger a host of anxieties for most people. Bringing back memories of being chosen last for teams in high school. I mean, who would want to end up in the lowest division? Well, it seems that in the Bats, Div 7 is where it's at.
They don't necessarily win the most games, but they definitely have the most fun.
I think there's something quite bonding about being beginners and learning together, and they often play with absolutely no expectation of what the result will be.
I think playing with some of the other teams, they said that we were really fun to play because we're not aggro when it's not going our way, because often isn't not going our way.
I think that we also have very much a culture of fair play in the club, like kind of a no dickheads policy, where we don't want people to be stupidly aggressive on the pitch or to, you know, be bad sports.
That's what I was worried about, like my first game, that I was going to do everything wrong and everyone would be annoyed that they had this person on their team who'd sucked. But like, I feel like if you try, everyone will be like super supportive.
Mardi Gras is coming up and preparations are in full swing.
We've been having a lot of fun organising dance routines, outfits and getting prepared for what will be our biggest entry, and I'm starting to get quite excited.
Like other community groups who are marching in the parade, the Bats are using public parks in the inner city to rehearse their choreography. To paint you a picture, that's 80 people dancing in formation to this song. Marks the 40th year of Mardi Gras in Sydney, and the parade has certainly grown from its origins as a demonstration of gay solidarity to what it is now, a celebration of a diverse rainbow community with many identities and many stories. This change is something that the Flying Bats are taking very seriously within their own club.
So for example, we put aside a couple of places for refugees each year, and we get folks referred to us where we might be the appropriate club for them. It's to be a part of the community rather than to be isolated. I think that we've been trying to actually show some leadership on being trans inclusive. That's something that a lot of sport really is not grappling well with at the moment, and I think that we're doing a good job providing an example of how it can just easily be integrated.
that it's not frightening, that it's not confronting, that it's not weird, that it's not unfair.
Soccer is a nice excuse for people to hang out and form new networks, really. When you ask people what the club means to them, very few of them talk about soccer. People use words like community and family to talk about their experiences with the club. And I think it's important to put some kind of framework around that so that we can support those things.
An explosion of glitter and joy. The parade claims Oxford Street as float after float pump their dance music and high-five the crowds lining the street. And proudly sporting their club jerseys, 80 flying bats march behind a giant inflated soccer ball and silver letters spelling out the words, Football for All.
Yeah, it's about we absolutely pride ourselves on something inclusive and diverse. That covers so many spectrums and the letters get numerous these days around all of the types, but we really genuinely wanted to evolve from being a lesbian football club to being a football club that includes all and sundry from around, and we want to be the place where people can go to feel really comfortable. So I think that pretty much sums up where we're at.
That story was produced by Tegan Nichols. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present and future. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Beck Fari. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Jordan Fennell is our SYN Production Manager. Tegan Nichols compiles the show and I'm Samantha Groth, your host. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and all our other episodes are at allthebestradio.com. We'd love you to subscribe to All the Best on your favourite podcast app so you have something to listen to next time you skip PE class.